Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of the book of Genesis. We've now come to Genesis chapter 10, post-flood. As a matter of historical context, Moses, our author, provides us a map of the nations descended from Noah and his three sons. However, the main focus is to trace the genealogical line from Noah through his son Shem down to Abraham, God's servant and the patriarch of the nation Israel. Now, these are the records of the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah. The sons were born to them after the flood. And then we have a listing of their various progeny. This chapter informs us about all the peoples who sprung from Noah and were in the larger geographical neighborhood during that general period. This is a narration of roots that has been dubbed the Table of Nations. In such genealogies, as I mentioned as the last program was winding down, the most important genealogy is usually reserved for the last mentioned and treated more expansively. Biblical scholarship on this chapter is full of speculation about this roster of nations. Many of these names that appear in this chapter are obscure to modern scholarship. The scholarly literature is filled with X, maybe Y, or some think Z, and so forth. But here's the truth. We aren't able in our day to identify a lot of these. We can't even say that in every case the relationship is based upon physical descent. Scholars think some of the links may be based on geographical or historical or linguistic connections. The fact is, folks, we just really don't know for sure. Still, there are some very interesting relationships that we do know. We notice, for example, in verse 4, that the mariners of the ancient world, those who spread out from Mesopotamia, that was the grand central station of the post-flood population, who spread out from Mesopotamia and then populated the seacoast and the islands of the various seas, were descended from Japheth, who developed maritime commerce. And the sons of Javan were Elisha and Tarshish and Kittim and Dodanim. From these, the coastlands of the nations were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, and into their nations. All of this expansion evidently occurred after the earth was divided. See that in verse 25. The earth is said to be divided in verse 25 in the days of Peleg, who is a Shemite. This appears to be an anticipatory reference to the confusion of languages at Babel. See that in chapter 11. I will interject that I personally am not so sure that that event did not occur simultaneously, the division of the languages, with a geographical division of the earth. If so, that would have accelerated the confusion of the languages. The progeny of Japheth, the Japhethites, as has been pointed out, lived in territories more remote from the Shemites or Semites, from which descended the elect line of Abraham. When we think of the Gentile world, we think primarily of the descendants of Japheth. Many see an intended connection between the 70 nations cataloged here and the 70 members of Jacob's family that descended into Egypt. They see that as a hint that Israel would have a God-given mission to the nations to bring to the world the light of the gospel. That's plausible. I doubt that that's probable, but honestly, I don't know. Still, a few of these names are identifiable. Javan, verse 4, has been identified with the Ionian Greeks. Those were the Greeks settled not in Greece proper, but those settled in Southwest Asia Minor, now known as Turkey, particularly settled in Southwest Asia Minor along the coastline. The Rhodonites appear to be the island of Rhodes. The Kittites are Cyprians, that is, people of Cyprus. We read in verse 6 that the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. The sons of Cush were Seba, Havilah, and Sabta, and Raamah, Sabteca, and the sons of Raamah were Sheba and Dedan. Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, the saying, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, in the land of Shinar. And from that land he went forth into Assyria, Nimrod that is, and built Nineveh, and Raboth-ir, and Calah, and Rezin, between Nineveh and Calah, that is, the great city. And on it goes. The descendants of Ham, verse 6, Hamites, figure most prominently in the future story of God's elect people, especially Egypt and Canaan. You say, where is Egypt? That's Mizraim. There were two Egypts. That's what it means, two Egypts, upper and lower. That im is plural. Canaan was the son of Ham whom God cursed as a result of Ham's perverse sin in the case of his father Noah. Canaan was the forebear of the Canaanites whom Israel dispossessed when they entered the promised land under Joshua. Put is thought to refer to the territory of modern Libya. From Cush we get Ethiopia, the nation south of Egypt, and once a very powerful nation. That was the territory of Queen Candace and the famed Ethiopian eunuch of the Book of Acts. The descendants of Ham appeared to have settled southwestern Asia and northeastern Africa, more or less. Understand that these territories were settled by these individual descendants of Noah's sons. And those names became the names of peoples and then countries which those families settled. Even today, in our own country, one runs into cities, towns, and villages named after some person or prominent person who first settled there. Those are called eponymous names. Cush, the son of Ham, mentioned in verse 8, is significant. For from him descended a notable figure in ancient times, a man by the name of Nimrod. Linguistically, Nimrod's very name has rebellion written all over it. Apparently, Nimrod in his time was a person who attracted the attention of heaven itself in his pretensions. In different times and climes, human beings gained status by various means and talents. In that ancient day, one could make a reputation as someone to be reckoned with as a hunter. Nimrod apparently was an iconic figure in that regard. The man was a heroic hunter, and that reputation gave him such standing for overweening aggression that he turns his talent for hunting animals to warfare, hunting people, and establishing for his own time renown as a mighty warrior king. The text says he founded Babylon, the site of ancient Babel, which appears in chapter 11. He also founded other cities in the region of Shinar, the area of Babylon. From there, he expanded his territory northward to Assyria, where Nimrod founded ancient Nineveh. That was his power base. Some have identified him perhaps as Sargon I, king of ancient Akkad. Maybe, maybe not. Truth is, we don't know. Roots are important in biblical perspective. Babylon, if you don't know it, is an archetype of rebellion against God. Babylon becomes the archetype of the world system that comes to full bloom at the end of the age in Babylon the Great of the book of Revelation. What was in Babylon that was so hateful to God was in its founder, Nimrod. In short, it's the old lesson we all know. The apple doesn't fall very far from the tree. By God's grace, there are wonderful exceptions, but absent grace, that proverb proves so true much of the time. Roots, roots. Always look at them because they produce the fruits we later see. This brings us now to chapter 11. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east. They found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower, whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. This is what they began to do, and now nothing which they propose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So, verse 8, the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, or Babylon. The root is confusion, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. At this time, the post-flood world enjoyed the luxury of a common language and speech. That expression is a roundabout way of saying everybody spoke the same language. The notion that everybody spoke a few words, which is linguistically possible, does not pass the context test, which is always the final arbiter for the meaning of words. Everybody was still in point of time, proximate or close to the time of the flood, so that everybody conveniently spoke the same language, and so far no difficult dialects had developed. Apparently, for whatever reason, the new population migrated from Eirat, where the ark had come to rest, migrated south, eastward, and eventually settled in the plain of Shinar, which was later called Babylonia. There was a broad plain, according to the Greek historian Herodotus. Incidentally, as many commentators remark, in Genesis, from the time of Adam's expulsion from the Garden of Eden, there is usually an ominous sign when a party or parties move east, which seemed to be, for some reason, the preferred direction of human migration in those times. It was the same for Cain. In verse 3, the narration of the Tower of Babel event is very sparse. It's unadorned. That's so often the case in biblical narratives. The lessons embedded in the event are drawn out and clearly underlined. However, we are supposed to read the clues and be discerning if we have eyes to see, because narrative proceeds by indirection. "Let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." If natural stones were available, there appears to be a lesson here. instead of using for their works the resources God had provided, namely natural stones. They resorted to what mankind has so often done in the course of human history. They fabricated their own means of salvation, in this case, finding a way to get in touch with God in their own way, to build a gigantic ziggurat. Moses seems to make a special point of this substitution. They used bricks instead of stones, tar for mortar. Human beings have perennially tried to build for themselves a better, safer life by their own designs than by God's provisions. That is one reason life for so many so regularly goes south. Well, in verse 4, a bad outcome is virtually promised for their project, a project which is founded on godless motives. Let's unpack them. Come, let us build ourselves a city. Right there, they're off to a bad start. The way they express it does not pass the smell test. Notice in their construction aims, there is nothing about honoring God. Their vision is all about themselves. Note, let us build for ourselves. So much that people and mankind in general undertake to accomplish or to perform is at best narrowly humanitarian and at worst self-serving or both. Instead of getting on board with God's plan to live our lives for His glory and do whatever we can do to honor His name, mankind tends to bend its shoulders, marshal its energies, pool its resources, and frame its visions to do something for ourselves. Then, folks, we wonder why so many of our human accomplishments, so much of our work on this earth, falls short of our projections, winds up in disappointment, and in the toilet bowl of our own imaginations. The pride of life, that's what we see here, starts right here. Starts right here with a visionary project, that is, for ourselves. Let us build a city for ourselves. In our sinful natures, we even find ways to build churches for ourselves, magnificent though they may be. Let us build a city. Nobody should accuse them of lacking vision. They were dreamers. They wanted to do something big. None of the builders was content with being a small fry. They wanted for themselves to plant in the plain of Shinar, a shining city. But there was so much wrong with this vision, as there usually is with all human projects. In and of itself, there was no sin in building a city for the sake of the community. Even God said, "It is not good for man to be alone." It's nice to have neighbors, even sometimes close neighbors, so we can help and support one another and accomplish bigger things than maybe could have been accomplished in a village or on a farm. The inherent problem is not an urban vision. What was wrong in this primeval drive to build a city was the motives. The same thing that is so regularly wrong with even some of the more beneficial human enterprises. Philanthropy, for example, can be socially beneficial, but most of the time the gifts are driven by lower rather than higher motives, seldom by godly incentives. Same way, way back here. In the midst of the city, they proposed to construct an imposing, ginormous tower that would reach far into the heavens. It appears that they imagined that if they could accomplish this project, they would attain to the heavens where God or gods or whatever was thought to dwell. Thereby, they felt they could more or less co-opt God and His powers and functions so that they might supplant Him and really be independent of Him or them. At the same time, they explicitly hoped to make a name or reputation for themselves, not for God, but for themselves. That self-centered incentive has sin and human pride written all over it in bold letters. And that bad seed has never left the human race. You see it every day, everywhere, in every fashion, people godlessly striving to make a name for themselves, and see people trying to usurp the place of God in directing their own actions independently. All this was right there on display at Babel, and it flowered big time centuries later in its namesake, Babylon. Something more was wrong with this Tower of Babel vision. You will note it was driven by fear, by the fear of being scattered all over the face of the land. That prospect evoked a fear of vulnerability, reflected a fear of inability to cope with life and its circumstances. So, we note, instead of drawing closer to God and depending upon Him for their needs, they reasoned and decided to attempt to quell their fears and anxieties in their own way, not through close communion with God, not sheltering themselves under the wings of the Almighty, but they wanted to achieve fearlessness through the unity of human community. That was what they thought would make them feel safe and sufficient in the face of all their fears. You know what? That's where the scriptures are so timeless. Nothing has changed about that, has it? In Hebrews, we are told that human beings through fear of death have been subject to slavery, to sin and Satan all their lives, chapter 2, verses 14 through 15. In its outward manners and customs, the world has vastly changed from generations past. Its technology, yes, but in terms of human nature and its attitudes and actions, especially toward God, nothing has changed. Folks, the apple, I say, has not fallen far from the tree at last. We keep getting the same deadly results, but man is one animal on earth that is incapable of learning from his past mistakes. But the Lord came down. This is not to be understood literally, as if an all-knowing God had to exit his throne in heaven, come down on earth to figure out what on earth these people were up to. I say obviously, because so interpreting it would violate one of the great laws of biblical interpretation, which is that the inspired word, rightly understood, does not contradict itself. God is pure spirit. God does not exist in human form. John chapter 4. And God is omniscient, unlike ourselves. He knows all things. He doesn't have to ask. So that means this language is of a kind that we find abundantly in Scripture, known as anthropomorphism. That means man form. It's used for various effects, here to get across that God was intimately in touch with the actions of the post-diluvians, that is, those living after the flood. And he was personally concerned. He is also immanent, present, close to and involved in his creation. And this is a picturesque way of communicating that idea. We saw it in Eden also, where God was heard walking in the garden. We see it also when he is said to go to Sodom and investigate their doings. So man was trying in his own way to ascend up to the dwelling place of God and place himself on par with God and achieve security from all threats on his own terms. Ironically, here God meets man where he is, at ground level, in all of his vain pretensions. To meet God, man has to go up. To meet man, God comes down, has to stoop to survey the silliness of proud humankind. Well, folks, our time has expired there with verse 6. We'll come back and finish this last section in our next study and move on to chapter 12. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.